Look at you, says Helen. You are like cross-eyed with lust. I am ashamed of you. How could you let yourself get into such a state? She laughs. Seriously, Claire, why don't you just get it over with?
I can't, I say miserably.
Sure you can. Just walk downstairs and yell, fuck me, and about 50 guys would be yelling, me, me.
You don't understand. I don't want... It's not that...
She wants somebody in particular, Ruth says, without taking her eyes off the pool. Who? Helen asks. I shrug my shoulders. Come on, Claire, spit it out.
Leave her alone, Laura says. If Claire doesn't want to say, she doesn't have to.
I am sitting next to Laura, and I lean my head on her shoulder. Helen bounces up. I'll be right back.
Where are you going?
I brought some champagne and pear juice to make Bellinis, but I left it in the car. She dashes out the door. A tall guy with shoulder-length hair does a backward somersault off the diving board.
Ooh la la, say Ruth and Laura in unison.
A long time has passed, maybe an hour or so. I eat half the potato chips and drink the warm Coke Claire has brought along. I nap a bit. She's gone for so long that I'm starting to consider going for a walk. Also, I need to take a leak. I hear heels tapping toward me. I look out the window, but it's not Claire. It's this bombshell blonde girl in a tight red dress. I blink and realize that this is Claire's friend, Helen Powell. Uh-oh. She clicks over to my side of the car, leans over, and peers at me. I can see right down her dress to Tokyo. I feel slightly woozy.
Hi, Claire's boyfriend. I'm Helen.
Wrong number, Helen, but pleased to meet you. Her breath is highly alcoholic.
Aren't you going to get out of the car and be properly introduced?
Oh, I'm pretty comfortable where I am, thanks.
Well, I'll just join you in there then.
She moves uncertainly around the front of the car, opens the door, and plops herself into the driver's seat.
I've been wanting to meet you for the longest time, Helen confides.
You have? Why? I desperately wish Claire would come and rescue me. But then that would give the game away, wouldn't it? Helen leans toward me and says, sotto voce,
I deduced your existence. My vast powers of observation have led me to the conclusion that whatever remains when you have eliminated the impossible is the truth, no matter how impossible. Hence,
Helen pauses to burp.
How unladylike, excuse me. Hence, I have concluded that Claire must have a boyfriend, because otherwise she would not be refusing to fuck all these very nice boys who are very much distressed about it. And here you are. Ta-da!
I've always liked Helen, and I'm sad to have misled her. This does explain something she said to me at our wedding, though. I love it when little puzzle pieces drop into place like this. That's very compelling reasoning, Helen, but I'm not Claire's boyfriend.
Then why are you sitting in her car?
I have a brainstorm. Claire is going to kill me for this. I'm a friend of Claire's parents. They were worried about her taking the car to a party where there might be alcohol, so they asked me to go along and play chauffeur in case she got too pickled to drive. Helen pouts. That's extremely not necessary. Our little Claire hardly drinks enough to fill a tiny, tiny thimble. I never said she did. Her parents were just being paranoid. High heels click down the sidewalk. This time it is Claire. She freezes when she sees that I have company. Helen jumps out of the car and says,
Claire, this naughty man says he is not your boyfriend.
Claire and I exchange glances.
Well, he's not, says Claire curtly.
Oh, says Helen.
Are you leaving? It's almost midnight. I'm about to turn into a pumpkin.
Claire walks around the car and opens her door.
Come on, Henry, let's go.
She starts the car and flips on the lights. Helen stands stock still in the headlights. Then she walks over to my side of the car.
Not her boyfriend, huh, Henry? You had me going there for a minute. Yes, you did. Bye-bye, Claire. She laughs, and Claire pulls out of the parking space awkwardly and drives away. Ruth lives on Conger. As we turn onto Broadway, I see that all the street lights are off. Broadway is a two-lane highway. It's ruler straight, but without the street lights, it's like driving into an inkwell. Better turn on your brights, Claire, I say. She reaches forward and turns the headlights off completely. Claire, don't tell me what to do! I shut up. All I can see are the illuminated numbers on the clock radio. It's 11:36. I hear the air rushing past the car, the engine of the car. I feel the wheels passing over the asphalt, but somehow we seem to be motionless, and the world moves around us at 45 miles per hour. I close my eyes. It makes no difference. I open them. My heart is pounding. Headlights appear in the distance. Claire turns her lights on and we are rushing along again, perfectly aligned between the yellow stripes in the middle of the road and the edge of the highway. It's 11:38. Claire is expressionless in the reflected dashboard lights. Why did you do that? I ask her, my voice shaking. Why not? Claire's voice is calm as a summer pond. Because we could have both died in a fiery wreck? Claire slows and turns onto Blue Star Highway. But that's not what happens, she says. I grow up and meet you and we get married and here you are. For all you know, you crashed the car just then and we both spent a year in traction. But then you would have warned me not to do it, says Claire. I tried, but you yelled at me. I mean, an older you would have told a younger me not to crash the car. Well, by then it would have already happened. We have reached Megrim Lane and Claire turns onto it. This is the private road that leads to her house. Pull over, Claire, okay? Please? Claire drives onto the grass, stops, cuts the engine and the lights. It's completely dark again, and I could hear a million cicadas singing. I reach over and pull Claire close to me, put my arm around her. She is tense and unpliant. Promise me something. What? Claire asks. Promise you won't do anything like that again. I mean, not just with the car, but anything dangerous. Because you don't know. The future is weird, and you can't go around behaving like you're invincible, but if you've seen me in the future, trust me. Just trust me. Claire laughs. Why would I want to do that? I don't know. Because I love you? Claire turns her head so quickly that she hits me in the jaw. Ouch! Sorry. I can barely see the outline of her profile. You love me? She asks. Yes. Right now? Yes. But you're not my boyfriend. Oh. That's what's bugging her. Well, technically speaking, I'm your husband. Since you haven't actually gotten married yet, I suppose we would have to say that you are my girlfriend. Claire puts her hand someplace it probably shouldn't be. I'd rather be your mistress. You're 16, Claire. I gently remove her hand and stroke her face. That's old enough. Ugh, your hands are all wet. Claire turns on the overhead light, and I'm startled to see that her face and dress are streaked with blood. I look at my palms, and they're sticky and red. Henry, what's wrong? I don't know. I lick my right palm, and four deep, crescent-shaped cuts appear in a row. I laugh. It's from my fingernails, when you were driving without the headlights. Claire snaps off the overhead light, and we're sitting in the dark again. The cicadas sing with all their might. I didn't mean to scare you. Yeah, you did. But usually, I feel safe when you're driving. It's just... What? I was in a car accident when I was a kid, and I don't like to ride in cars. Oh, I'm sorry. It's okay. Hey, what time is it? Oh my God! Claire flips the light on. 12:12. I'm late. And how can I walk in all bloody like this? She looks so distraught that I want to laugh.
Here. I rub my left palm across her upper lip and under her nose. You have a nosebleed.
Okay.
She starts the car, flips on the headlights, and eases back onto the road.
Etta's going to freak when she sees me.
Etta, what about your parents?
Mama's probably asleep by now, and it's Daddy's poker night.
Claire opens the gate and we pass through. If my kid was out with the car the day after she got her license, I would be sitting next to the front door with a stopwatch. Claire stops the car out of sight of the house.
Do we have kids?
Sorry, that's classified.
I'm going to apply for that one under the Freedom of Information Act.
Be my guess. I kiss her carefully, so as not to disturb the faux nosebleed. Let me know what you find out. I open the car door. Good luck with Etta.
Good night.
Night. I get out and close the door as quietly as possible. The car glides down the drive, around the bend, and into the night. I walk after it toward a bed in the meadow under the stars. Sunday, September 27th, 1987. Henry is 32, Claire is 16. I materialize in the meadow, about 15 feet west of the clearing. I feel dreadful, dizzy, and nauseated, so I sit for a few minutes to pull myself together. It's chilly and gray, and I'm submerged in the tall brown grass which cuts into my skin. After a while, I feel a little better, and it's quiet, so I stand up and walk into the clearing. Claire is sitting on the ground next to the rock, leaning against it. She doesn't say anything, just looks at me with what I can only describe as anger. Uh-oh, I think. What have I done? She's in her Grace Kelly phase. She's wearing her blue wool coat and a red skirt. I'm shivering and I hunt for the clothes box. I find it and don black jeans, a black sweater, black wool socks, a black overcoat, black boots, and black leather gloves. I look like I'm about to star in a Wim Wenders film. I sit down next to Claire.
Hi, Claire. Are you okay?
Hi, Henry. Here. She hands me a thermos and two sandwiches.
Thanks. I feel kind of sick, so I'll wait a little.
I set the food on the rock. The thermos contains coffee. I inhale deeply. Just the smell makes me feel better.
Are you all right?
She's not looking at me. As I scrutinize Claire, I realize that she's been crying.
Henry, would you beat someone up for me?
What?
I want to hurt someone, and I'm not big enough, and I don't know how to fight. Will you do it for me?
Whoa. What are you talking about?
Who? Why?
Claire stares at her lap.
I don't want to talk about it. Couldn't you just take my word that he totally deserves it?
I think I know what's going on. I think I've heard this story before. I sigh and move closer to Claire and put my arm around her. She leans her head on my shoulder. This is about some guy you went on a date with, right?
Yeah.
And he was a jerk, and now you want me to pulverize him?
Yeah.
Claire, lots of guys are jerks. I used to be a jerk. Claire laughs.
I bet you weren't as big of a jerk as Jason Everlay.
He's a football player or something, right?
Yes.
Claire, what makes you think I can take on some huge jock half my age? Why were you even going out with someone like that? She shrugs.
At school, everybody's been bugging me because I never date anyone. Ruth and Meg and Nancy. I mean, there are all these rumors going around that I'm a lesbian. Even Mama is asking me why I don't go out with boys. Guys ask me out and I turn them down. And then Beatrice Dilford, who is a dyke, asked me if I was, and I told her no, and she said that she wasn't surprised, but that's what everybody was saying. So then I thought, well, maybe I'd better go out with a few guys. So the next one who asked was Jason. He's like this jock, and he's really good-looking. And I knew that if I went out with him, everyone would know, and I thought maybe they would shut up.
So this was the first time you went out on a date?
Yeah. We went to this Italian restaurant, and Laura and Mike were there, and a bunch of people from theater class. And I offered to go Dutch, but he said no, he never did that, and it was okay. I mean, we talked about school and stuff, football.
Then we went to see Friday the 13th Part 7, which was really stupid in case you were thinking of seeing it. I've seen it.
Oh. Why?
Doesn't seem like your kind of thing.
Same reason you did. My date wanted to see it.
Who was your date?
A woman named Alex.
What was she like?
A bank teller with big tits who liked to be spanked. The second this pops out of my mouth, I realize that I'm talking to Claire, the teenager, not Claire, my wife, and I mentally smack myself in the head.
Spanked?
Claire looks at me, smiling, her eyebrows halfway to her hairline. Never mind. So, you went to a movie and...
Oh, well, then he wanted to go to Travers.
What is Travers?
It's a farm on the north side.
Claire's voice drops. I can hardly hear her.
It's where people go to make out.
I don't say anything.
So I told him I was tired and wanted to go home, and then he got kind of, mad.
Claire stops talking.
For a while we sit, listening to birds, airplanes, wind. Suddenly Claire says, he was really mad.
What happened then?
He wouldn't take me home. I wasn't sure where we were. Somewhere out on Route 12. He was just driving around down little lanes. God, I don't know. He drove down this dirt road, and there was this little cottage. There was a lake nearby. I could hear it. And he had the key to this place.
I'm getting nervous. Claire never told me any of this. Just that she once went on a really horrible date with some guy named Jason who was a football player. Claire has fallen silent again. Claire, did he rape you?
No. He said I wasn't good enough. He said, no, he didn't rape me. He just hurt me. He made me.
She can't say it. I wait. Claire unbuttons her coat and removes it. She peels her shirt off. And I see that her back is covered with bruises. They're dark and purple against her white skin. Claire turns and there's a cigarette burn on her right breast, blistered and ugly. I asked her once what that scar was and she wouldn't say. I'm gonna kill this guy. I am going to cripple him. Claire sits before me, shoulders back, goose flesh waiting. I hand her shirt and she puts it on. All right. I tell her quietly. Where do I find this guy? I'll drive you, she says. Claire picks me up in the Fiat at the end of the driveway, out of sight of the house. She's wearing sunglasses even though it's a dim afternoon, and lipstick, and her hair is coiled at the back of her head. She looks a lot older than 16. She looks like she just walked out of a Rear Window, though the resemblance would be more perfect if she was blonde. We speed through the fall trees, but I don't think either of us notices much color. A tape loop of what happened to Claire in that little cottage has begun to play repeatedly in my head. How big is he? Claire considers.
A couple inches taller than you.
A lot heavier. 50 pounds?
Christ. I brought this.
Claire digs in her purse and produces a handgun.
Claire! It's Daddy's.
I think fast. Claire, that's a bad idea. I mean, I'm mad enough to actually use it, and that would be stupid.
Ah, wait.
I take it from her, open the chamber, and remove the bullets and put them in her purse. There, that's better. Brilliant idea, Claire. Claire looks at me questioning. I stick the gun in my overcoat pocket. Do you want me to do this anonymously, or do you want him to know it's from you?
I want to be there.
Oh. She pulls into a private lane and stops.
I want to take him somewhere, and I want you to hurt him very badly, and I want to watch. I want him scared, shitless.
I sigh.
Claire, I don't usually do this kind of thing.
I usually fight in self-defense, for one thing.
Please.
It comes out of her mouth absolutely flat.
Of course.
We continue down the drive and stop in front of a large, new, faux colonial house. There are no cars visible. Van Halen emanates from an open second-floor window. We walk to the front door and I stand to the side while Claire rings the bell.
After a moment, the music abruptly stops, and heavy footsteps clump downstairs. The door opens, and after a pause, a deep voice says,
What? You come back for more?
That's all I need to hear. I draw the gun and step to Claire's side. I point it at the guy's chest.
Hi, Jason, Claire says. I thought you might like to come out with us.
He does the same thing I would do. Drops and rolls out of range, but he doesn't do it fast enough. I'm in the door and I take a flying leap onto his chest to knock the wind out of him. I stand up, put my boot on his chest, point the gun at his head.
C'est magnifique, mais ce n'est pas la guerre.
He looks kind of like Tom Cruise. Very pretty, all American. What position does he play? I ask Claire.
Halfback.
Never would have guessed. Get up, hands up where I can see them, I tell him cheerfully. He complies and I walk him out the door. We're all standing in the driveway. I have an idea. I send Claire back into the house for rope. She comes out a few minutes later with scissors and duct tape.
Where do you want to do this?
The woods. Jason is panting as we march him into the woods. We walk for about 5 minutes, and then I see a little clearing with a handy young elm at the edge of it. How about this, Claire?
Yeah.
I look at her. She is completely impassive. Cool as a Raymond Chandler murderess. Call it, Claire. Tie him to the tree. I hand her the gun, jerk Jason's hands into position behind the tree, and duct tape them together. There's almost a full roll of duct tape, and I intend to use all of it. Jason is breathing strenuously, wheezing. I step around him and look at Claire. She looks at Jason as though he's a bad piece of conceptual art. Are you asthmatic? He nods. His pupils are contracted into tiny points of black.
I'll get his inhaler, says Claire.
She hands the gun back to me and ambles off through the woods along the path we came down. Jason is trying to breathe slowly and carefully. He's trying to talk.
Who are you?
He asks hoarsely.
I'm Claire's boyfriend. I'm here to teach you manners since you have none.
I drop my mocking tone and walk close to him and say softly, How could you do that to her? She's so young. She doesn't know anything, and now you've completely fucked up everything.
She's a cock tease.
She has no idea. It's like torturing a kitten because it bit you. Jason doesn't answer. His breath comes in long, shivering whinnies. Just as I'm becoming concerned, Claire arrives. She holds up the inhaler, looks at me.
Darling, do you know how to use this thing?
I think you shake it and then put it in his mouth and press down on the top. She does this, asks him if he wants more. He nods. After 4 inhalations, we stand and watch him gradually subside into more normal breathing. Ready? I ask Claire. She holds up the scissors, makes a few cuts in the air. Jason flinches. Claire walks over to him, kneels, and begins to cut off his clothes.
Hey!
Says Jason. Please be quiet, I say. No one is hurting you. At the moment. Claire finishes cutting off his jeans and starts on his t-shirt. I start to duct tape him to the tree. I begin at his ankles and wind very neatly up his calves and thighs. Stop there, Claire says, indicating a point just below Jason's crotch. She snips off his underwear. I start to tape his waist. His skin is clammy and he's very tan everywhere except a crisp outline of a Speedo-type bathing suit. He's sweating heavily. I wind all the way up to his shoulders and stop, because I want him to be able to breathe. We step back and admire our work. Jason is now a duct-taped mummy with a large erection. Claire begins to laugh. Her laugh sounds spooky, echoing through the woods. I look at her sharply. There's something knowing and cruel in Claire's laugh. And it seems to me that this moment is the demarcation, a sort of no man's land between Claire's childhood and her life as a woman. What's next? I inquire. Part of me wants to turn him into a hamburger, and part of me doesn't want to beat up somebody who's taped to a tree. Jason is bright red. It contrasts nicely with the gray duct tape.
Oh,
says Claire. You know, I think that's enough. I'm relieved. So of course I say, you sure? I mean, there are all sorts of things I could do. Break his eardrums, nose. Oh, wait. He's already broken it once himself. We could cut his Achilles tendons. He wouldn't be playing football in the near future.
No!
Jason strains against the tape. Apologize, then, I tell him. Jason hesitates.
Sorry.
That's pretty pathetic. I know, Claire says. She fishes around in her purse and finds a magic marker. She walks up to Jason as though he's a dangerous zoo animal and begins to write on his duct-taped chest. When she's done, she stands back and caps her marker. She's written an account of their date. She sticks the marker back in her purse and says, "Let's go." You know, we can't just leave him. He might have another asthma attack. Okay, I know. I'll call some people.
Wait a minute, says Jason.
What? Says Claire.
Who are you calling? Call Rob.
Claire laughs. I'm gonna call every girl I know. I walk over to Jason and place the muzzle of the gun under his chin. If you mention my existence to one human and I find out about it, I will come back. And I will devastate you. You won't be able to walk, talk, eat, or fuck when I'm done. As far as you know, Claire's a nice girl who for some inexplicable reason doesn't date. Right? Jason looks at me with hatred. Right. We've dealt with you very leniently here. If you hassle Claire again in any way, you will be sorry. Okay. Good. I place the gun back in my pocket. It's been fun.
Listen, dickface.
Oh, what the hell. I step back and put my whole weight into a sidekick to the groin. Jason screams. I turn and look at Claire, who is white under her makeup. Tears are running down Jason's face. I wonder if he's going to pass out. Let's go, I say. Claire nods. We walk back to the car, subdued. I can hear Jason yelling at us. We climb in, Claire starts the car, turns, and rockets down the driveway and onto the street. I watch her drive. It's beginning to rain. There's a satisfied smile playing around the edges of her mouth. Is that what you wanted? I ask. Yes, says Claire. That was perfect. Thank you. My pleasure. I'm getting dizzy. I think I'm almost gone. Claire pulls onto a side street. The rain is drumming on the car. It's like riding through a car wash. Kiss me, she demands. I do, and then I'm gone.
Monday, September 28th, 1987. Claire is 16. At school on Monday, everybody looks at me, but no one will speak to me. I feel like Harriet the Spy after her classmates found her spy notebook. Walking down the hall is like parting the Red Sea. When I walk into English, first period, everyone stops talking. I sit down next to Ruth. She smiles and looks worried. I don't say anything either, but then I feel her hand on mine under the table, hot and small. Ruth holds my hand for a moment, and then Mr. Partaki walks in and she takes her hand away, and Mr. Partaki notices that everyone is uncharacteristically silent. He says mildly, "Did you all have a nice weekend?" And Sue Wong says, "Oh, yes!" And there's a shimmer of nervous laughter around the room. Partaki is puzzled, and there's an awful pause. Then he says, "Well, great. Then let's embark on Billy Budd. In 1851, Herman Melville published Moby Dick, or The Whale, which was greeted with resounding indifference by the American public." It's all lost on me. Even with a cotton undershirt on, my sweater feels abrasive and my ribs hurt. My classmates arduously fumble their way through a discussion of Billy Budd. Finally, the bell rings, and they escape. I follow, slowly, and Ruth walks with me. "Are you okay?" she asks. "Mostly. I did what you said." "What time?" "Around 6. I was afraid his parents would come home and find him. It was hard to cut him out. The tape ripped off all his chest hair." "Good. Did a lot of people see him?" "Yeah, everybody. Well, all the girls. No guys, as far as I know." The halls are almost empty. I'm standing in front of my French classroom. "Claire, I understand why you did it. But what I don't get is how you did it." "I had some help." The passing bell rings and Ruth jumps. "Oh my God, I've been late to gym 5 times in a row." She moves away as though repelled by a strong magnetic field. "Tell me at lunch," Ruth calls as I turn and walk into Madame Simone's room. "Ah, Mademoiselle Absher, asseyez-vous, s'il vous plaît." I sit between Laura and Helen. Helen writes me a note. "Good for you." The class is translating Montaigne. We work quietly, and Madame walks around the room correcting. I'm having trouble concentrating. The look on Henry's face after he kicked Jason, utterly indifferent, as though he had just shaken his hand, as though he was thinking about nothing in particular. And then he was worried because he didn't know how I would react. And I realized that Henry enjoyed hurting Jason. And is that the same as Jason enjoying hurting me? But Henry is good. Does that make it okay? Is it okay that I wanted him to do it? "Claire, attendez," Madame says at my elbow. After the bell once again, everyone bolts out. I walk with Helen. Laura hugs me apologetically and runs off to her music class at the other end of the building. Helen and I both have third period gym. Helen laughs. "Well, dang, girl! I couldn't believe my eyes! How'd you get him taped to that tree?" I can tell I'm going to get tired of that question. I have a friend who does things like that. He helped me out.
"Who is he?"
"A client of my dad's," I lie. Helen shakes her head. "You're such a bad liar." I smile and say nothing. "It's Henry, right?" I shake my head and put my finger to my lips. We have arrived at the girls' gym. We walk into the locker room and, abracadabra, all the girls stop talking. Then there's a low ripple of talk that fills the silence. Helen and I have our lockers in the same bay. I open mine and take out my gym suit and shoes. I have thought about what I am going to do. I take off my shoes and stockings, strip down to my undershirt and panties. I'm not wearing a bra because it hurt too much. "Hey, Helen," I say. I peel off my shirt and Helen turns.
"Jesus Christ, Claire!"
The bruises look even worse than they did yesterday. Some of them are greenish. There are welts on my thighs from Jason's belt.
"Oh, Claire!"
Helen walks to me and puts her arms around me carefully. The room is silent, and I look over Helen's shoulder and see that all the girls have gathered around us, and they are all looking. Helen straightens up and looks back at them and says, "Well?" And someone in the back starts to clap. And they are all clapping, and laughing, and talking, and cheering. And I feel light. Light as air. Wednesday, July 2nd, 1995. Claire is 24. Henry is 32. I'm lying in bed, almost asleep, when I feel Henry's hand brushing over my stomach and realize he's back. I open my eyes, and he bends down and kisses the little cigarette burn scar. And in the dim nightlight, I touch his face. "Thank you," I say. And he says, "It was my pleasure." And that is the only time we ever speak of it.
Sunday, September 11th, 1988. Henry is 36, Claire is 17. Claire and I are in the orchard on a warm September afternoon. Insects drone in the meadow under golden sun. Everything is still. And as I look across the dry grasses, the air shimmers with warmth. We're under an apple tree. Claire leans against its trunk with a pillow under her to cushion the tree roots. I'm lying stretched out with my head in her lap. We've eaten, and the remains of our lunch lie scattered around us with fallen apples interspersed. I'm sleepy and content. It is January in my present, and Claire and I are struggling. This summer interlude is idyllic. Claire says, "I'd like to draw you. Just like that. Upside down and asleep. Relaxed. You look so peaceful." "Why not?" "Go ahead." We're out here in the first place because Claire is supposed to be drawing trees for her art class. She picks up her sketchbook and retrieves the charcoal. She balances the book on her knee. "Do you want me to move?" I ask her. "No. That would change it too much. As you were, please." I resume staring idly at the patterns the branches make against the sky. Stillness is a discipline. I can hold quite still for long stretches of time when I'm reading. But sitting for Claire is always surprisingly difficult. Even a pose that seems very comfortable at first becomes torture after 15 minutes or so. Without moving anything but my eyes, I look at Claire. She's deep in her drawing. When Claire draws, she looks as though the world has fallen away, leaving only her and the object of her scrutiny. This is why I love to be drawn by Claire. When she looks at me with that kind of attention, I feel that I'm everything to her. It's the same look she gives me when we're making love. Just at this moment, she looks into my eyes and smiles. "I forgot to ask you. When are you coming from?" "January 2000. Her face falls. "Really? I thought maybe a little later." "Why? Do I look so old?" Claire strokes my nose. Her fingers travel across the bridge and over my brows. "No, you don't. But you seem happy and calm. And usually when you come from 1998 or 99 or 2000, you're upset or freaked out and you won't tell me why. And then in 2001, you're okay again." I laugh. "You sound like a fortune teller. I never realized you were tracking my mood so closely. What else have I got to go on?" "Remember, it's stress that usually sends me in your direction here. So you shouldn't get the idea that those years are unremittingly horrible. There are lots of nice things in those years, too." Claire goes back to her drawing. She's given up asking me about our future. Instead, she asks, "Henry, what are you afraid of?" The question surprises me, and I have to think about it. "Cold," I say. "I'm afraid of winter. I'm afraid of police. I am afraid of traveling to the wrong place and time and getting hit by a car or beat up, or getting stranded in time and not being able to come back. I'm afraid of losing you." Claire smiles. "How could you lose me? I'm not going anywhere." "I worry that you'll get tired of putting up with my undependableness and you'll leave me." Claire puts her sketchbook aside. I sit up. "I won't ever leave you," she says, "even though you're always leaving me. But I never want to leave you." Claire shows me the drawing. I've seen it before. It hangs next to Claire's drawing table in her studio at home. In the drawing, I do look peaceful. Claire signs it and begins to write the date. "Don't," I say. "It's not dated." "It's not?" "I've seen it before. There's no date on it." "Okay." Claire erases the date and writes "Meadowlark" on it instead. "Done." She looks at me, puzzled. "Do you ever find that you go back to your present and something has changed? I mean, what if I wrote the date on this drawing right now? What would happen?" "I don't know. Try it," I say, curious. Claire erases the word "Meadowlark" and writes September 11th, 1988. "There," she says. "That was easy." We look at each other bemused. Claire laughs. If I violated the space-time continuum, it isn't very obvious. I'll let you know if you've caused World War III. I'm starting to feel shaky. I think I'm going, Claire. She kisses me, and I'm gone. Thursday, January 13th, 2000. Henry is 36, Claire is 28. After dinner, I'm still thinking about Claire's drawing, so I walk out to her studio to look at it. Claire is making a huge sculpture out of tiny wisps of purple paper. It looks like a cross between a Muppet and a bird's nest. I walk around it carefully and stand in front of her table. The drawing isn't there. Claire comes in carrying an armful of abaca fiber. Hey. She throws it on the floor and walks over to me. What's up? Where's the drawing that used to hang right there? The one of me? Huh? Oh. I don't know, maybe it fell down. Claire dives under the table and says, I don't see it. Oh, wait, here it is. She emerges holding the drawing between two fingers. Ugh, it's all cobwebby. She brushes it off and hands it to me. I look it over. There's still no date on it. What happened to the date? What date? You wrote the date at the bottom here, under your name. It looks like it's been trimmed off. Claire laughs. Okay, I confess. I trimmed it. Why? I got all freaked by your World War III comment. I started thinking, what if we never met in the future because I insisted on testing this out? I'm glad you did. Why? I don't know. I just am. We stare at each other, and then Claire smiles and I shrug and that's that. But why does it seem as though something impossible almost happened? Why do I feel so relieved? Christmas Eve, 1. Always crashing in the same car. Saturday, December 24th, 1988. Henry is 40, Claire is 17. It's a dark winter afternoon. I'm in the basement in Meadowlark House in the reading room. Claire has left me some food. Roast beef and cheese on whole wheat with mustard, an apple, a quart of milk, and an entire plastic tub of Christmas cookies. Snowballs, cinnamon nut diamonds, and peanut cookies with Hershey's Kisses stuck into them. I'm wearing my favorite jeans and a Sex Pistols t-shirt. I ought to be a happy camper, but I'm not. Claire has also left me today's South Haven Daily. It's dated December 24th, 1988. Christmas Eve. This evening, in the Get Me High Lounge in Chicago, my 25-year-old self will drink until I quietly slide off the bar stool and onto the floor and end up having my stomach pumped at Mercy Hospital. It's the 19th anniversary of my mother's death. I sit quietly and think about my mom. It's funny how memory erodes. If all I had to work from were my childhood memories, my knowledge of my mother would be faded and soft, with a few sharp moments standing out. When I was 5, I heard her sing Lulu at the Lyric Opera. I remember Dad, sitting next to me, smiling up at Mom at the end of the first act with utter exhilaration. I remember sitting with Mom at Orchestra Hall, watching Dad play Beethoven under Boulez. I remember being allowed to come into the living room during a party my parents were giving and reciting Blake's Tiger, Tiger Burning Bright to the guests, complete with growling noises. I was 4, and when I was done, my mother swept me up and kissed me, and everyone applauded. She was wearing dark lipstick, and I insisted on going to bed with her lip prints on my cheek. I remember her sitting on a bench in Warren Park while my dad pushed me on a swing, and she bobbed close and far, close and far. One of the best and most painful things about time traveling has been the opportunity to see my mother alive. I've even spoken to her a few times. Things like, lousy weather today, isn't it? I give her my seat on the L, follow her in the supermarket, watch her sing. I hang around outside the apartment my father still lives in and watch the two of them, sometimes with my infant self, take walks, eat in restaurants, go to the movies. It's the 60s, and they are elegant, young, brilliant musicians with all the world before them. They are happy as larks. They shine with their luck, their joy. When we run across each other, they wave. They think I'm someone who lives in the neighborhood, someone who takes a lot of walks, someone who gets his hair cut oddly and seems to mysteriously ebb and flow in age. I once heard my father wonder if I was a cancer patient. It still amazes me that Dad has never realized that this man lurking around the early years of their marriage was his son. I see how my mother is with me. Now she's pregnant. Now they bring me home from the hospital. Now she takes me to the park in a baby carriage and sits memorizing scores, singing softly with small hand gestures to me, making faces and shaking toys at me. Now we walk hand in hand and admire the squirrels, the cars, the pigeons, anything that moves. She wears cloth coats and loafers with capri pants. She is dark-haired with a dramatic face, a full mouth, wide eyes, short hair. She looks Italian, but actually she's Jewish. My mom wears lipstick, eyeliner, mascara, blush, and eyebrow pencil to go to the dry cleaners. Dad is much as he always is. Tall, spare, a quiet dresser, a wearer of hats. The difference is his face. He is deeply content. They touch each other often, hold hands, walk in unison. At the beach, the three of us wear matching sunglasses, and I have a ridiculous blue hat. We all lie in the sun slathered in baby oil. We drink rum and coke and Hawaiian punch. My mother's star is rising. She studies with Jayon Mech, with Mary Delacroix, and they carefully guide her along the paths of fame. She sings a number of small but gem-like roles, attracting the ears of Louis Behar at the Lyric. She understudies Linnea Waverley's Aida. Then she is chosen to sing Carmen. Other companies take notice, and soon we're traveling around the world. She records Schubert for Decca, Verdi and Weill for EMI, and we go to London, to Paris, to Berlin, to New York. I remember only an endless series of hotel rooms and airplanes. Her performance at Lincoln Center is on television. I watch it with Graham and Gramps in Muncie. I'm 6 years old, and I hardly believe that it's my mom, there in black and white on the small screen. She is singing Madama Butterfly. They make plans to move to Vienna after the end of the Lyric 69-70 season. Dad auditions at the Philharmonic. Whenever the phone rings, it's Uncle Ish, Mom's manager, or someone from a record label. I hear the door at the top of the stairs open and clap shut, and then slowly descending footsteps. Claire knocks quietly 4 times, and I remove the straight-back chair from under the doorknob. There's still snow in her hair, and her cheeks are red. She's 17 years old. Claire throws her arms around me and hugs me excitedly. "Merry Christmas, Henry," she says. "It's so great you're here." I kiss her on the cheek. Her cheer and bustle have scattered my thoughts, but my sense of sadness and loss remains. I run my hands over her hair and come away with a small handful of snow that melts immediately. "What's wrong?" Claire takes in the untouched food, my uncheerful demeanor. "You're sulking because there's no mayo?" "Hey, hush." I sit down on the broken old lazy boy and Claire squeezes in beside me. I put my arm around her shoulders. She puts her hand on my inner thigh. I remove it and hold it. Her hand is cold. "Have I ever told you about my mom?" "No." Claire is all ears. She's always eager for any bits of autobiography I let drop. As the dates on the list grow few and our 2 years of separation loom large, Claire is secretly convinced she can find me in real time if I would only dole out a few facts. Of course, she can't, because I won't, and she doesn't. We each eat a cookie. "Okay. Once upon a time, I had a mom. I had a dad, too, and they were very deeply in love. And they had me. And we were all pretty happy. And both of them were really terrific at their jobs, and my mother, especially, was great at what she did. And we used to travel all over, seeing the hotel rooms of the world. So it was almost Christmas. What year?" "The year I was 6. It was the morning of Christmas Eve, and my dad was in Vienna because we were going to move there soon, and he was finding us an apartment. So the idea was that Dad would fly into the airport, and Mom and I would drive out and pick him up, and we would all continue on to Grandma's house for the holidays. It was a gray, snowy morning, and the streets were covered in sheets of ice that hadn't been salted yet. Mom was a nervous driver. She hated expressways, hated driving to the airport, and had only agreed to do this because it made a lot of sense. We got up early, and she packed the car. I was wearing a winter coat, a knit hat, boots, jeans, a pullover sweater, underwear, wool socks that were kind of tight, and mittens. She was dressed entirely in black, which was more unusual then than it is now. Claire drinks some of the milk directly from the carton. She leaves a cinnamon-colored lipstick print. What kind of car? It was a white 62 Ford Fairlane. What's that? Look it up. It was built like a tank. It had fins. My parents loved it. It had a lot of history for them. So we got in the car. I sat in the front passenger seat. We both wore our seat belts. And we drove. The weather was absolutely awful. It was hard to see, and the defrost in that car wasn't the greatest. We went through this maze of residential streets, and then we got on the expressway. It was after rush hour, but traffic was a mess because of the weather and the holiday. So we were moving maybe 15, 20 miles an hour. My mother stayed in the right-hand lane, probably because she didn't want to change lanes without being able to see very well, and because we weren't going to be on the expressway very long before we exited for the airport. We were behind a truck, well behind it, giving it plenty of room up there. As we passed an entrance, a small car, a red Corvette, actually, got on behind us. The Corvette, which was being driven by a dentist who was only slightly inebriated at 10:30 a.m., got on just a bit too quickly and wasn't able to slow down soon enough because of the ice on the road and hit our car. And in ordinary weather conditions, the Corvette would have been mangled, and the indestructible Ford Fairlane would have had a bent fender and it wouldn't have been that big of a deal. But the weather was bad. The roads were slick. So the shove from the Corvette sent our car accelerating forward just as traffic slowed down. The truck ahead of us was barely moving. My mother was pumping the brakes, but nothing was happening. We hit the truck practically in slow motion, or so it seemed to me. In actuality, we were going about 40. The truck was an open pickup truck full of scrap metal. When we hit it, a large sheet of steel flew off the back of the truck, came through our windshield, and decapitated my mother. Claire has her eyes closed.
No.
It's true.
But you were right there. You were too short.
No. That wasn't it. The steel embedded in my seat right where my forehead should have been. I have a scar where it started to cut my forehead. I show Claire. It got my hat. The police couldn't figure it out. All my clothes were in the car, on the seat and the floor. And I was found stark naked by the side of the road.
You time traveled.
Yes. I time traveled. We were silent for a moment. It was only the second time it ever happened to me. I had no idea what was going on. I was watching us plow into this truck and then I was in the hospital. In fact, I was pretty much unhurt, just in shock.
Why do you think it happened?
Stress. Pure fear. I think my body did the only trick it could. Claire turns her face to mine, sad and excited.
So?
So, Mom died and I didn't. The front end of the Ford crumpled up. The steering column went through Mom's chest. Her head went through the now empty windshield and into the back of the truck. There was an unbelievable amount of blood. The guy in the Corvette was unscathed. The truck driver got out of his truck to see what hit him, saw Mom, fainted on the road and was run over by a school bus driver who didn't see him and was gawking at the accident. The truck driver had two broken legs. Meanwhile, I was completely absent from the scene for 10 minutes and 47 seconds. I don't remember where I went. Maybe it was only a second or two for me. Traffic came to a complete halt. Ambulances were trying to come from three different directions and couldn't get near us for half an hour. Paramedics came running on foot. I appeared on the shoulder. The only person who saw me appear was a little girl. She was in the back seat of a green Chevrolet station wagon. Her mouth opened and she just stared and stared. But, Henry, you said you don't remember. And how could you know this anyway? 10 minutes and 47 seconds, exactly? I'm quiet for a while, searching for the best way to explain. You know about gravity, right? The larger something is, the more mass it has. The more gravitational pull it exerts. It pulls smaller things to it, and they orbit around and around. Yes? My mother dying. It's the pivotal thing. Everything else goes around and around it. I dream about it, and I also time travel to it. Over and over. If you could be there, and could hover over the scene of the accident, and you could see every detail of it, all the people, cars, trees, snowdrifts. If you had enough time to really look at everything, you would see me. I'm in cars, behind bushes, on the bridge, in a tree. I've seen it from every angle. I'm even a participant in the aftermath. I called the airport from a nearby gas station to page my father with the message to come immediately to the hospital. I sat in the hospital waiting room and watched my father walk through on his way to find me. He looks gray and ravaged. I walked along the shoulder of the road waiting for my young self to appear, and I put a blanket around my thin child's shoulders. I looked into my small, uncomprehending face and I thought, I'm weeping now. Claire wraps her arms around me, and I cry soundlessly into her mohair sweatered breasts. What? What, Henry? I thought I should have died too. We hold each other. I gradually get hold of myself. I've made a mess of Claire's sweater. She goes to the laundry room and comes back wearing one of Alicia's white polyester chamber music playing shirts. Alicia's only 14, but she's already taller and bigger than Claire. I stare at Claire, standing before me. And I'm sorry to be here. Sorry to ruin her Christmas. I'm sorry, Claire. I didn't mean to put all this sadness on you. I just find Christmas difficult. Oh, Henry, I'm so glad you're here. And, you know, I'd rather know. I mean, you just come out of nowhere and disappear, and if I know things about your life, you seem more real. Even terrible things, I need to know as much as you can say. Alicia's calling down the stairs for Claire. It is time for Claire to join her family. To celebrate Christmas. I stand and we kiss cautiously. And Claire says, coming, and gives me a smile and then she's running up the stairs. I prop the chair under the door again and settle in for a long night. Christmas Eve, 2. Saturday, December 24th, 1988. Henry is 25. I call Dad and ask if he wants me to come over for dinner after the Christmas matinee concert. He makes a half-hearted attempt at inviting me, but I back out to his relief. The official De Tambell Day of Mourning will be conducted in multiple locations this year. Mrs. Kim has gone to Korea to visit her sisters. I've been watering her plants and taking in her mail. I call Ingrid Carmichael and ask her to come out with me, and she reminds me crisply that it's Christmas Eve and some people have families to kowtow to. I run through my address book. Everyone is out of town or in town with their visiting relatives. I should have gone to see Graham and Gramps. Then I remember they're in Florida. It's 2:53 in the afternoon and stores are closing down. I buy a bottle of schnapps at Al's and stow it in my overcoat pocket. Then I hop on the L at Belmont and ride downtown. It's a gray day and cold. The train is half full, Mostly people with their kids going to see Marshall Field's Christmas windows and do last-minute shopping at Water Tower Place. I get off at Randolph and walk east to Grant Park.